This episode is brought to you by Tegas, the only investment research platform built for fundamental investors. Think about how hard you are working to get the insights you need to make a great investment decision, how many hours you spend digging through public records and expert transcripts, or manually updating those complex models. Investors should compete on their ability to analyze investments, not how well they aggregate data. That's why Tegas offers a unified end-to-end research platform that combines robust qualitative content sets, up-to-date financial data, management and culture checks, and more, all in one easy-to-use, streamlined user experience. 95% of the top 20 global private equity firms use Tegas. Learn more and get your free trial at tegas.com/Patrick. Today's episode is sponsored by Public.com. That's where you can earn a 5.1% annual percentage yield with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say for certain that's the highest interest rate out there, we can say that at the time of this recording, that's higher than Robinhood, higher than SoFi, Marcus, Wealthfront, higher rate than Betterment, Capital One, Ally, Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo. I think you get the point here. If you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. Full disclosures and terms and conditions can be found in the podcast description, U.S. members only.
This is Business Breakdowns. Business Breakdowns is a series of conversations with investors and operators diving deep into a single business. For each business, we explore its history, its business model, its competitive advantages, and what makes it tick. We believe every business has lessons and secrets that investors and operators can learn from, and we are here to bring them to you. To find more episodes of Breakdowns, check out joincolossus.com.
All opinions expressed by hosts and podcast guests are solely their own opinions. Hosts, podcast guests, their employers, or affiliates may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions.
Welcome back to Business Breakdowns. Today, we explore a major player in the reseller economy, that is Winmark. You're likely familiar with some of Winmark's brands like Plato's Closet or Play It Again Sports, but together, Winmark operates five brands through a franchising model. Our guest to break down Winmark is the current CEO, Brett Hefes. Now, we listen to our audience and we try to be cognizant of the guests we invite. The overwhelming majority of our audience prefers investors to management teams. So why did we explore this episode with Brett? Well, Winmark doesn't host conference calls, and their investor relations are generally limited to financial reports, some very basic management commentary, and some rare public appearances. That alone was intriguing to us, but I'd add, when we talked to Brett, it was very clear this was not an investor relations exercise. So during our conversation, we get into the broader reseller economy, the dynamics of managing those brands and different franchise brands, and how Winmark approaches this and thinks about growth. In the back half of the conversation, I also made sure to talk to Brett about his thoughts on capital allocation, focusing the business, and yes, on investor communication. Winmark has been a very interesting business to me, so if you're looking to learn more on top of the episode, don't hesitate to reach out, send me a message, email, social media, whatever you prefer. Now, please enjoy this breakdown of Winmark. All right, Brett, excited to have you here on Business Breakdowns. We have gone into the world of franchising before, but I think Winmark sits in a very unique category in the resale market that we certainly haven't covered, and I think it's going to be of interest to our listeners. I thought we could just start out with an introduction on Winmark. It's not necessarily a household brand. I think some of its franchises are household brands. So maybe you could just kick us off there with an introduction to the business.
Sure. Thanks, Matt. Really appreciate being on the podcast today. I mean, we talk about Winmark. We're Winmark, the resale company, and we believe we're the resale company. So we're responsible for a network of 1,319 locally owned buying centers in communities all across North America. And we have a very simple and pure mission to provide resale for everyone. And we do have five brands. We are more well known for the individual brands, like you said. They're Plato's Closet, which is teen apparel, and that's our largest. Once Upon a Child, which is children's apparel and hard goods. We have a pretty big sporting goods business and Play It Again Sports. And then we have Style Encore, which is men's and women's apparel, and Music Around, which is musical instruments. Our focus as a company is on value-oriented items. So think Walmart, Target, Carter's, Old Navy, Adidas, Nike, Under Armour. These are the brands and the items that really sell well in our stores and the brands that we're buying from our consumers every day when they come in to the door. So we provide access to quality used products at value pricing. And the thing that's so interesting is these lower priced items, they have less places to go when you're done with them. And unfortunately, they end up in landfills. So as a result of this focus, we've been doing this for over 35 years. Windmark's been a leader in the circular economy, and our environmental and community impact is absolutely massive. We've kept 1.7 billion items out of landfills since 2010 and have returned over $1 billion in cash to the communities we serve in the past 24 months alone. And I think the last piece of this is our resale business is delivered through a franchise model, Matt. We don't have any corporate stores. And we think that franchising is a very appropriate model for the resale industry.
I'm certainly familiar with your brands, Play It Again Sports being one major, and I think I will be increasingly familiar with your brands as I have young children growing up and those clothes. As you mentioned, there's a lot of use for them, and then they have nowhere to go. And I want to get into that resale market a bit more. It's this interesting, as you referenced, circular economy, which I like that phrasing there. Can you just share a bit more about what that economy looks like? I think it makes all the sense in the world that we should be focusing on that more and more as consumers, but just a little snapshot of it, as you seem like you're a key player in that space, and how you would, if you can quantify that market sizing, any of the dynamics that have gone on in terms of the trends there. It's something that I think is increasingly important, but maybe not talked about nearly enough.
When I joined Windmark over 21 years ago, I don't even think the word resale was a term that was being used. We thought of ourselves as a franchisor of concepts that buy and sell gently used goods. But over the years, the business has evolved, the market's evolved, and there's been a lot of new entrants. All of these things combined have really dramatically pushed the industry forward. There's new estimates that come out every year. Frankly, sometimes they're hard to believe. But the most recent numbers that I reviewed were a U.S. secondhand apparel market of over $40 billion, with resale accounting for $23 billion of this. We also participate in Canada, and then we participate in sporting goods and musical instruments. There's not as much data around those categories, but they're also very, very large markets for previously used items. So in the past, if you look at the history, the growth of the market was really driven by younger people, by early adopters, and value-conscious consumers. But it's pretty clear now that there is just very widespread participation in this market. And a recent study that I reviewed shared that over 50% of consumers shop secondhand apparel in 2023. So it's very wide in terms of participation. There's a few other things to touch on about the variety of the business models. I think it warrants some discussion because not all resale companies are created equal. And we've defined a very specific positioning in the industry. I mentioned earlier, we believe we're Windmark, the resale company, because true resale is what we do. Our stores buy and sell used items on a daily basis, and we believe we're the only company doing this at scale. So what that means is we pay you cash for your items. And on average, each store paid out over $400,000 in cash to customers in the community. That's over $1,100 a day they're paying out. We focus on the value end of the spectrum, and that's why we're set up the way we are, because we can actually buy and sell low-priced items profitably for our franchisees. And we think that for those class of goods, it's the most sustainable option. There's no packaging, there's no shipping, there's no robots moving around the warehouse. And more importantly, the goods get shipped into the community once and they stay there. There are a variety of other models. Some of them are very different than ours. Consignment is a big one. That's a concept that we get confused sometimes. People think we're a consignment company, but consignment is a big area. And that's where the players in the marketplace, they're not principals, they're agents. So you'll see companies touting terms such as take rate or GMV or other metrics. And when you hear companies saying that, it just means that they don't take ownership of the inventory and there's less certainty for the consumer. You bring in your kids' clothes to our store, we'll tell you, we want to buy it, we don't want to buy it, here's the price. So it's very clear. The other models just don't provide that certainty. And to be clear, they're very valid models. They're more prevalent than ours, frankly. They're just different. There's a donation model out there. Everyone in the States, at least, knows about Goodwill or Salvation Army or Savers. It's a very different business model because they're not paying for their inventory. They're getting it as a donation, but it's also very good for the environment because they handle huge volumes. And then there's a peer-to-peer business. Think about Facebook Marketplace, Poshmark, eBay. That's when you do the work on your own. You're going to list that item yourself, typically better for higher priced items because you're not going to take the time and energy to do that for a $2 or $3 item. And then brands themselves are starting to get into this as well. Because when you're a brand, a branded apparel company, a branded sporting good company, you make a trust and you make quality items that have a long life. Right now, they're only getting remuneration one time when it gets sold. So all the brands are trying to figure out, how do I participate in the second, third, and fourth time the goods traded hands? And we've started some sustainability partnerships in the sporting good business with Rawlings Baseball, with CCM Hockey, and in the disc golf business with Innova and Elon Skis. And we're able to showcase these brands as sustainable options. So they feel good about working with us and consumers feel good about shopping with them. A major competitor, though, and I still think the biggest competitor to us, is the landfill. Because still too many people just don't take the time to pursue one of these options, or they're not aware of these options. I think the industry needs to be very focused on being more convenient so that more customers can responsibly dispose of their items.
You pointed to an interesting differentiation point for your business versus the rest of the industry, and that is that you take ownership of the items, you put the cash out. I'm wondering, how do you work with your franchisees in order to make those purchasing decisions? Can you just kind of bring us into the store experience that is managing risk in some ways in terms of putting cash out and ensuring that you can then resell that item on the back end? How is the system set up such that you can educate your franchisees and the business owners in order to do that effectively?
We've been developing a point of sale system for over 20 years. And that pricing matrix in terms of what to pay is inherent in that point of sale system. If we wanted to, we could teach you how to buy under 30 minutes. It's that easy. So we look at the style, the brand, the condition, and there's sort of standard retail price points that we know consumers want to hit. So with a few touches of the touch screen, it really points out what to pay for the item and what the item will sell for. So it doesn't need a big team of data scientists. It's really not that complicated, but it's a ton of brands, it's a ton of price points, and it's all organized really easily for the franchisee. And now we also support the franchisee with training, with style and trend guides, what to buy, what not to buy, because there is fashion component to this. And we do our best to stay on top of those and also to continually communicate with the franchisees about what's working. We have a very good understanding of what brands are selling, what brands are not selling, and passing that through the system.
And do the franchisees ultimately have the decision-making capability such that when it comes into items where they are more fashion-oriented, they can make the decision? Are there guardrails set up? Because it is a tight relationship where you both rely on one another. And I'm just curious how much leeway they have when it comes to those decisions.
All the purchasing decisions at the point of attack are the franchisees. So it's 100% theirs. We have the system in place. We train them how to do it, but ultimately they make the call on what to buy because it's their capital. It's really easy for me to sit here and say, buy this, buy that, but it's not my capital, it's theirs. So they take that responsibility very seriously. The worst thing we can do for a customer is turn away an item that's a quality item, because then they lose confidence in that store, in that location. So our stores really want to buy everything they can. We train them to want to buy everything they can, but sometimes they can't. How you communicate that to a customer is a really important part of the training, because we don't want people to feel bad. We're not judging the quality of their items or their lifestyle or anything. We're just saying, hey, this particular item isn't going to sell well in our stores today, so we're not going to be able to purchase it.
And is all of the inventory then managed, I assume, at the local level as well?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. that's one of the keys of our business model at Windmark. I mean, the reason why I think franchising is the right model for this business is because each store is paying out that $1,100 a day. It's their capital. They're hiring the people. And when they buy, when they have excess inventory, they need to figure out how to clear it. And we help them with that. It's this network. You're not on your own when you're in the local market because you have 1,318 other colleagues all around North America. But sometimes they feel like they're alone. And that's the give and take of being a franchisor and a franchisee. I don't think this would work at a corporate level to have a bunch of corporate employees trying to commit capital on behalf of the mothership.
No, I certainly agree with you. There's some unique aspects to skin in the game and allowing that decentralized management while also having the centralized education system and everything that goes into that. Maybe we can transition a little bit into the business model itself. I understand there's kind of a royalty stream that comes up, but when you think about operating the business, you described how many franchises you have. How would you walk through the business model and any important components to it when you're thinking about it?
There's a couple of things. I think the one thing that we need to do a better job of as a company is our customers, our families, their individuals. In the apparel business, we can serve men and women's fashion needs from newborn to retiree. If we're doing our job right in the community, we can acquire you as a newborn customer and keep you for more than 50 years. The span of it doesn't really get talked about all the time, but it's really impressive in terms of there's not many businesses where you can keep a customer for that long, maybe a toothpaste or consumer products or something like that. But in our world, there's really not that many out there. So if you think about the business model, the vehicle for which we provide our services is franchising. And at its most basic level, think of it as like a distributed system of locally owned buying centers. I touched on that before. All we want our stores to do is advertise, bring us your gently used items, and we'll pay you cash on the spot. And if you treat them well, if you're fair, if you evaluate the items, you pay them cash for the things that will sell well in the store. If you communicate why we're not purchasing the things we can't purchase and you educate them on how it all works, they buy also, and they buy a lot. So we buy the inventory, those goods get put on the shelf, and they get sold from like 50 to 80% off of regular retail for the comparable new product, and customers buy a lot of it. $1.6 billion almost in sales last year alone. So it's a really straightforward model. I mentioned alignment before, but we're 100% aligned with our franchisees. The only way we're successful at Windmark is if they're successful. There's no possible way for us to be successful without them being successful. Because as you referenced, our only meaningful form of compensation are those continuing fees based on sales. So it's very powerful because what it means is that our entire company is focused on supporting the franchisees. We don't have any locations, any corporate locations to kind of change our focus. And when you're all about teaching and training and support, you really approach things differently. Because I can tell you that every employee at this company comes into work every day trying to answer one question. How can I help the franchisees get better? That's all we care about. We completed over 3,000 support visits last year. And that's why we had a 99% renewal rate last year and we had our highest level of system-wide sales. So the business model is pretty straightforward and that's about it.
The description there in terms of how you're bringing customers into the store through buying items, we talk a lot about unique customer acquisition strategies, and it's definitely one that fits into there. It ultimately turns into a positive CAC in a lot of ways where you get that inventory on hand. Are there any data points just in terms of what set of the customers are both selling and buying? I would imagine that a large percentage are on both sides of the transaction over time.
Yeah, a ton. I mean, it varies by brand, but you're well over 50%. Well over 50% are both. And that's the sweet spot for us. I don't believe that anyone is going to only buy used or only buy new. On the end of the bell curve, you have people doing that today. Some people still won't buy new. And there are emerging people, a lot of influencers on Instagram that are only buying previously used. But the middle two thirds of the bell curve today, I think for quite some time, are going to be hybrid users.
Your earlier point on maintaining a customer through their entire life, that journey, as you have it set up now, each of the franchises have their separate brands. Is there anything that you do strategically to allow that natural evolution to keep the customer jumping from franchise to franchise?
That's harder to do on a national level, Matt. If I could wave my magic wand, I'm open. If you got any ideas for me, I'm open. It's more about the newborn comes into Once Upon a Child. They hit 12 or 13. They go over to Plato's Closet. They hit 25 to 30. They go over to Style Encore. It's more about being in the community that has all three. So we're not there yet on a master plan to do that, but it's just naturally occurring. But yeah, I'm really open. Any thoughts, shoot me a text or something.
I only ask the questions. I don't have the answers. That's how this is set up.
Yeah.
It's fair. You need to have the places at the very least.
Yeah.
When you look at the franchisees, do many of them own several franchises? What does it look like in terms of owning multiple franchises?
Yeah, I mean, there are. We have about 940 franchisees at this point in time. And we have, at the end of the year, I mean, the actual number was 1,319 locations. So it's about 1.4 is the number, but our mode is one. And we really like multi-unit owners, but if they can handle the second store and the third store. So we have a very cautious, it's not even cautious, it's just prudent model that we're not going to work with you on the second store until the first store is working right. And we're not going to add the second store unless you have an operational plan to have the second store. Because if you don't have another strong manager or a strong relative or strong partner in terms of operations, both of them are going to go down. So yeah, we'd like multi-unit owners, but our mode is clearly one here. And that's also something that's unique about Windmark is there aren't a lot of franchise concepts out there where you can be successful with just one concept, and you can here. And so if you want a second store, great. We work with people all the time, but we don't sign territory deals. You're going to develop 15 stores in a market over a period of time. We've dabbled with that over the years. It's been a complete and unmitigated disaster for us every time we've tried it. So we're just slow and steady wins the race is our view.
Curious just on what didn't work out with the territorial large build out. Was that more institutional capital that was coming in that maybe didn't have that same high touch neighborhood type approach? Was there anything else that made that result in a failure?
Yeah, I mean, some of this predates me, but some of it occurred on my watch, candidly. And the stuff that predates me is an entire state was granted to someone. And then if they don't develop on schedule or they're operating stores that are below system average, it ends up hurting the brand. And you think it's exciting when you sign them up because you can tout new agreements. But new agreements that don't open or new agreements that produce below system average harm everybody. Not only they harm Windmark, but they harm all the other franchisees. So we've locked that all down. Candidly, Matt, we get criticized sometimes because people want us to grow faster. And I guarantee you there's not a person in North America that wants to grow faster than me. I can guarantee that. But we've also seen the downsides of making bad decisions on picking franchise partners that aren't qualified. And I look at these people in the eyes. We have a discovery day every other week. I'm at almost every single one of them. And we talk to them and we say, if you follow the model, you're going to be successful. And I'm just not going to yield on that. I'll take the heat for the growth rate that maybe people want. They want it a little higher, but I want quality. And you go back to that renewal rate. And I'm just really comfortable about how we've managed this.
Yeah. There's a great saying, if you default on $1 million loan, you've got a problem. If you default on $1 billion loan, the bank's got a problem. And I think there's some truth to that that can extend into other industries as well.
Yeah.
Appreciate the thoughtfulness around that. When you're looking at those applications, maybe we could just go through the lens of what a franchisee agreement looks like. Any of the key data points that are important into what they look like from a length standpoint, what's expected, any of the metrics that you can point to just in terms of how those contracts work.
There's a qualitative piece that I'd like to just touch on first. Because we get so many leads, some of the leads turn into applications and some of the applications turn into agreements. It's a classic funnel. But the screening out process, they select out sometimes, we select them out sometimes. It's really focused around operationally qualifying and financially qualifying. And on the operational piece, We just have to get people to understand what the actual opportunity is. The job itself is really complex. So we want to uncover for them, hey, this is the actual job first. You're the bottle washer, you're the CEO, you're everything. And you're responsible for financial management, you're responsible for marketing, you're responsible for operations, staffing, customer service, community relations. So it's not for everybody, but for the right candidate, it's an amazing opportunity. The other key trait is just follow the operating model. A lot of what we do is pretty straightforward, Matt. I mean, just follow the operating model. We got 1,300 stores. We've been doing this for 30 years. We and our franchisees have made every mistake out there. So if you follow that operating model, we think you're going to have success. So then you get to the point of some of your questions around what's the contract look like? It's a pretty long legal document. There's a lot of regulations around what we can say and what we can't say, state by state. It's a pretty complex document. But at the end of the day, it boils down to we're going to license the franchisee our brand name. Winmark owns Plato's Closet. We're going to license you the right to use Plato's Closet. And the franchisee's obligation is to follow the business system that we have in a handbook. So hopefully they come in, we train them, we teach them the business system. Hopefully they follow the business system. And the financial piece of it is there's a weekly percent of sales that we get paid, and that's called the continuing fee. And there's a few other little things here and there. They're not profit centers for us. That's why I feel like this alignment concept is real, because it's just about that continuing fee. And it's really good to be able to look someone in the eye and say, if you do better, we do better. It's never a situation where you do worse and we do better. It's impossible, just impossible for that to happen. So it really enhances franchisee relationships because everything's never perfect. But I think that's the contract. It's really straightforward. If you want to talk a little bit about some of the traits of successful franchisees, I think you mentioned that.
Yeah, I think it'd be interesting. You mentioned maybe framing it through the operating manual that if you follow this, that's really the path. Maybe just discussing, you know, if there's certain things there that are common such that if people aren't doing them, that's where you often see mistakes are made. Or if they really lean into it, that's where you see a lot of the successes, and blend that with the traits of what makes for a successful operator.
Yeah, I mean, the biggest thing that franchisees sometimes get off the path a little bit on is what we would call limitations. A lot of inventory is coming in and they feel like they have to slow down and stop buying for a period of time. And we really are all over that as a company and trying to help educate them why it makes sense and what can happen. And more importantly, how to help them. Again, no one's saying we don't want to do it your way. It's like, we can't for this reason. Okay, then let's talk about how we can help you. And the other piece I would say in that operating manual is sometimes people aren't spending the necessary amount on marketing. The contract states, we talked about the contract, that they have to spend 5% of sales on marketing, that our average numbers are a little bit lower than that. And we think that getting that message out to everybody in the community is really important. And at a minimum, we think that 5% is the number, and that's what they sign up to do. So the limitations in the marketing, I think, are the most common. There's a whole host of other things that, you know, wacky things that people do over the years, but those are the ones that are about 95% of our time spent on helping the franchisees with.
Is there a marketing channel that's most effective for this category in your experience?
Right now, it's digital and social. It's just so cost-effective to tell your message that way, that is the way. When I started, our stores were doing cable TV. That was really effective back in the day, and radio. And there's still some of that, but digital and social is really the most effective, cost-effective way for the stores to advertise right now.
I was wondering if I was going to get direct mail. I still appreciate from time to time.
Depending upon the individual owner in your community, you may get some direct mail. But it just goes back to what you were talking about too, is like the traits of a successful. We have engineers, teachers, people from retail, people from all different walks of life. So it's not about what your business background is. It's, do you want to be a responsible member of the community? Do you buy into what we're doing, really, from a sustainability standpoint? Can you follow the model? And that's hard for some people that are very entrepreneurial because they want to tweak things. They want to try something new. And what we really try to get people to do is just run the model for a few years. Just do it per the handbook. And if you do it per the handbook and you're starting to have a lot of success and you're trying a new idea, just tell us. We don't sit here in Minneapolis and think of the next great idea for the store to execute. It'd be an abject failure if that was my job description. I mean, all the best ideas that have happened at the company, and operational ideas and local store marketing, and they've all happened from franchisees. So we see something working, and then our team, and we have some really talented employees and really talented management team, they figure out what can we package and blow it back out to the system that can impact hundreds and hundreds of stores. So that's what our skill set is. We're not terribly smarter than anybody else. We're very disciplined. That's a really good thing to have in this industry. And we're trying to just get them to follow the model. But the other thing that I've been thinking about a lot lately, actually, and I give you credit for this, is I was just so intrigued by the podcast I listened, Your Business Breakdowns podcast on Patek Philippe. And I really believe that our successful franchisees, they embrace the notion that our stores are legacy assets in the community. Because you act differently as an owner if you think what you're doing is permanent. It's not just a store that you're going to open and you're going to close. I wish Patek Philippe would license their tagline to me. I'd love to be able to say, like, consider that you never actually own a Winmark franchise. You merely look after it for the next generation. I mean, that is a, wow, that's a powerful marketing message. And it's why it truly breaks my heart when a store closes. It's not because of the financial impact to us. We have 1,300 stores. Like, one store closing from a financial standpoint, it's not going to impact us. But you have young families that now don't have access to our clothes, which is a problem. You have a couple going on a date that are teenagers for the first time that they want a new outfit and they can't go, or young kids playing hockey that can't get those new skates anymore. So that's the piece that we're trying to even amp up even more. We're starting to train on this when franchisees come in for new training. We're starting to roll this out for existing franchisees. You own a legacy asset for your community, and let's make sure that we're being proper stewards of these assets, because it's the community that's really benefiting from this a heck of a lot more than you as the owner or Winmark as the franchisor. So thank you for that inspiration.
Yes. Yeah. Inspiring on many levels, for sure, that podcast. The renewal rate that you mentioned before, 99% plus, it speaks for itself. I'm curious, over time, have you had large swings in that number? And anything in terms of that trend line that you watch or monitor very closely? It can obviously be due to macro reasons from time to time, but just that number, and obviously you want that to be as high as possible to fill that description that you just gave.
The single most important metric of the company is renewal rate. It speaks to franchisee health. It speaks to franchisee relations. You know, they sign 10-year agreements. We sign 10-year agreements with the franchisees. And at the end of the 10 years, they have a choice to extend and we have a choice to extend. 10 years is a long time. Last year, we renewed 176 of 177 agreements that were available, 99.4%. If you look over the past 5 years, it's 99.2%. We renewed 622 out of 627. We really focus in on these numbers. I know these numbers because it's really important to the whole company. And we're really proud of this. But if you look at over the past 10 years to answer the question about variability, our highest renewal rate was 100%. Our lowest was 97.4. So we really haven't had situations where en masse things weren't working out. We try to really identify early if we have a real focus on stores that are under a certain dollar threshold and try to work with them to sell. We have a very active M&A operation here where we transfer stores from existing owners to new owners. And so we try to identify the problems and help people get out gracefully before it comes to the end of their renewal and it's bad for everybody and bad for the community.
Bring it back to an earlier point you made with the manual. And one of the things that you will see sometimes is people will stop buying if they're overloaded with inventory or there's too much coming in. How do you help manage that? Because obviously, I would imagine that there are periods of time where you're just seeing more selling than buying. Is that ever a risk? Is it just something where it always ends up balancing out on the other side of it? Through previous cycles, it doesn't feel like we've had a really ugly macro cycle in a while. But through previous cycles, has that ever caused real stress on individual business operators?
It's definitely caused stress on individual stores. It's never been prevalent across the whole concept, if that makes sense. So part of it is, are you set up properly? Is your back counter organized properly? Are you staffed properly? There's just a lot of organizational things, like how you're set up. It's not due to the economy. We believe it's more operational in nature. It's more mindset in nature. Are you understanding that when you hang up that sign and says that we're not buying today, how much that negatively impacts the consumer experience?
I do want to transition a little bit to how you manage the corporate business. We've talked a lot about the existing model today. I know there was a fairly large change several years ago where you had an existing leasing business and decided to part ways with that or wind that down. Can you just bring us into the decision-making and thought process behind something like that? Maybe introduce us to what the leasing business was and then the decision to ultimately part with it.
We don't do a lot of investor relations, no analyst coverage, no calls. So this is not a question I've ever talked about publicly before. It was a really hard decision, but it was a very necessary decision that I think is worth delving into. So I really appreciate that you want to talk about that. But we've discussed that our current mission is to provide resale for everyone and all the work we've put into the rebranding and the refocusing of the company. And I attribute a lot of our recent success to those initiatives and that focus. But in the past, if we were having this conversation 10 years ago, our overall strategy was different. The sign behind me would have said, create, support, finance business. That was our tagline. And it was a very elegant way to connect two businesses that really didn't have anything in common. Franchising and leasing. Our leasing operations, we started a small ticket and a middle market equipment leasing operation in 2004. And the plan at the time, I mean, I literally can't believe that was 20 years ago because I was here when that happened. It's April 1 of 2004. It was to take the cash flow from the franchising business and deploy it in a really high returning finance product. And we started down that path. And 2008 and 2009 came. And that put a really big dent in our small ticket business. That was smaller transactions for small businesses. That piece of the business ended up being a real value detractor for Windmark. But we focused, we shrunk that down after that period of time and had a very small portfolio, but profitable portfolio. And we focused our effort on that middle market business where we were supplying technology equipment to middle market companies, private equity backed companies, venture backed companies, younger public companies. And we, as a business, we financed over $300 million. We purchased $300 million of equipment on behalf of our customers. And keep in mind that when we started that business, our market cap was $140 million. It was very substantial to us. It was over 70% of our balance sheet, and it was over 20% of our earnings per share. And the other piece of it was, I don't have a time clock or anything, but I estimate that I've probably spent 30 to 40% of my time on these businesses. So if you sort of step back from all that, it was a key part of our strategy. And you say, why did we make this decision? And what really happened was twofold. I think the first was, just candidly, we never were able to grow the leasing business fast enough to utilize the cash flow from franchising. We just never met our goals for customer acquisition. Actually, I would say we consistently missed our goals for adding new customers. But we still ended up with a small but very profitable business. It was an extremely profitable business if you go back and look at the numbers, but then it required no capital. So we had two businesses then that required no capital. But the most important thing to me was, if you look at this sustained period of time, I mean, this isn't a 1 month or 1 year decision. You look at a 20-year period of time, the core resale business, I mean, I think you can just hear it in my voice. It just vastly exceeded all of our expectations. And I just didn't think it was getting enough attention. And if you look back at our history from 2002 to 2021, we had a lot of different corporate development ideas here. We made minority investments in private companies. We started two leasing businesses at a very pivotal time in our history. We chose to start a franchise consulting business to find the next great idea in franchising. And throughout all of this, I just kept coming back to, and the management team kept coming back to the core. And it just got to the point of just answering a very simple question. Where should we be spending our time? It just became crystal clear. So in 2020, we sold the small ticket lease portfolio. We shut down the franchise consulting business. These moves were very necessary during COVID. We need to put 110% of our effort into the franchisees and to our employees during COVID. And then after that, the actual business decision was sort of a no-brainer to run it off We rebranded the company, we redefined the mission, and we were on our way. I can really tell you, since we've done this, the quality of the ideas, the desire, the ability to invest more in the business is a direct result of focusing all of our efforts on the resale industry. And the problem is these decisions, they're never easy because it impacts people. But now that it's 3 years in the rearview mirror, I truly believe it's probably the most important decision we've made in the past 10 years and maybe perhaps the past 20 years. We've never been more aligned with our franchisees, with our employees, with our shareholders. And I think we have absolute clarity regarding who we are and why we are here. I think our success is directly related to that. That's the progression. It wasn't a bad idea, just so we're clear. And it ended up combined being very profitable for our shareholders to be in those businesses. But the core resale business is really positive. So,
yeah, listening to the first 40 minutes of the conversation, there was so much strategy and thought and focus on that business. Then to hear that there was this tangential business, which is related but very separate, it makes sense and ties into the answer, I think, pretty thoughtfully. And the dynamics of how it could grow and how you were redeploying cash and how that evolved over time. I want to touch on that a little bit, just in terms of how you treat that capital allocation now with the cash flow that comes off of the franchising business. How do you approach that just strategically as a manager?
I mean, that's a question we get a lot. As you can imagine, our first tenet of capital allocation is run a good company. Because if you don't run a good company, there's no capital to allocate. Pretty simple stuff. And we do run a profitable company. So despite the significant investments we make in marketing and technology, we do have excess capital every year. And the philosophy is we don't want to retain excess cash on our balance sheet. And what we first do is we look to find high returning activities for investment that are consistent with our core resale operations. And historically, there have been very limited opportunities to do so. We look at a lot of things, we move forward with very few. So acquisitions are risky. Some of the minority investments are out there. It's just not things that we've done so far. It doesn't mean we're never going to do them. So we always look for higher return risk-adjusted activities. But as a result, the primary use of funds has been debt pay down, share repurchase, and special dividends. Right now, we have longer maturity debt at very low rates. So debt pay down isn't a great option. We have just very attractive financing in place that doesn't mature for many, many years. So it just doesn't make sense for us to do that. The next progression goes to share repurchases. We stay very disciplined and patient with respect to share repurchase. We only want to buy our stock in the open market if it's at a valuation that we deem to be proper. We've done a lot of this. We've repurchased 4.3 million shares in the last 20 years for about $350 million. We have under 3.5 million shares today. So it's a fairly active program. We don't do it by a formula. You see a lot of companies out there that are going to buy every quarter or buy to offset dilution. We don't think that has the potential to lead to good outcomes. Frankly, 2023 was the first time in 20 years that we didn't repurchase shares, but we do pay a quarterly dividend, which we think is set to a meaningful level for shareholders that they get a little payment every quarter, but it's not big enough that it hurts flexibility with some of these other ideas because I want flexibility to buy back stock or to pursue some other ideas that are value creating for all of us. But when all those things don't happen in any given year, we're very comfortable, very receptive paying out special dividends. And I've said this before, but shareholders really enjoy those. I mean, nothing makes your day getting seeing a press release that the company's paying a special dividend. And we've paid out special dividends in each of the last 4 years, totaling a little under $23 a share. So we just think it's a very straightforward policy. And we get a lot of positive feedback from shareholders on how we manage the capital structure and how we manage the capital allocation.
Yeah, we like to refer to that type of share buyback history as share cannibalization when you're eating your share count. In 2023, the decision-making process of no buybacks, but the special dividend, I assume that was what you referenced before, just on valuation.
Yeah.
And then the natural question always with the dividend policies and the tax impact about those, how do you balance that when it comes to the tax effectiveness of thinking about the buyback relative to the dividend and your approach, having been in the CFO position as well, to thinking about that?
I don't get too hung up. Our CFO, Tony, doesn't get too hung up on paying taxes. if the choice is buy stock that we think is not appropriately valued, keep cash on the balance sheet, or give it back to the owners of the company, taxes doesn't factor into that decision. It's just, we're going to give you your money back. It's yours. So we obviously hope that there's opportunity to buy stock in the future, because that's better for all of us if we can continue to do that. But I think it would be very foolish to consistently buy at levels that you don't think create value. At the end of the day, I'm responsible for running operations of the company, along with Rene Gaudet, our COO, and Tony and I are responsible for allocating the capital. And I just don't see a path forward where we're overpaying for our share. We're not always going to be right, but we've made enough decisions over the years that I'm comfortable being wrong sometimes. And the criticism is you should have bought more, I'm okay with that.
Understandable. One of the last questions I had, you referenced it before, the investor relations side of things. I think you have a unique approach where you don't do much in terms of conference calls or communications. And I've worked with other businesses that have operated similarly. Expeditors of Washington out on the West Coast, another famous example, at a chart that looks similar to yours. Past performance doesn't indicate anything about future results, but just the philosophy behind that and the focus on operations and not being as vocal on calls, events, and whatnot. Can you just talk a little bit about what goes into that?
We're a very unique company. One of the characteristics from a shareholder perspective, investor relations perspective, I think we're unique because 20 shareholders own 74% of the company. So it doesn't take us a lot to really understand. We wouldn't have to spend $40 million like Disney did or Pelz did to try to organize that. We would call up two of the top 20 work for the company. So we'd pick up the phone and call 18. Maybe there's three or four index funds that wouldn't return the call, but we'd get to everybody else. So I think that makes it the decision to do it the way we do it effective. I just really believe that if you're a shareholder, where do you want me spending my time? Do you want me on a conference call with analysts or trying to pitch our stock or at an analyst day? Or do you want me worried about finding the next market, being with a franchisee and helping them out? And I've never met a shareholder that doesn't want me spending my time on the core operations. We talk a lot about capital allocation in these formats because people are interested in it. It doesn't take up any time in my day. We have the policy in place. We move forward. So I think for us, we're easy to get a hold of. Someone wants to call us, a shareholder, a prospective shareholder. They call Tony, they call me, we talk to him. So it's just worked for us that way. And I just like keeping it simple. I've learned from someone who is really talented at this. I listened very carefully in terms of how he did it. It works, and I'm not going to change it. There's just no reason to change it. Because it's not like we suffered from a low valuation. I think we can have a different argument if that were the case.
If it's not broke, don't fix it.
Right.
I think that's a fair takeaway. And the focus on the business and the focus on what that core business is has been apparent throughout the conversation. We typically close with lessons from a business, and usually it's an investor looking at a business and those lessons that they could apply elsewhere. But I thought we could just take it even higher level. The lessons that you've taken away from your career, long time spent at Winmark, that you would share at the end of this conversation?
I probably have a couple. I think the first lesson that I would probably say is the most recent lesson, and we've touched on it a little bit, but it's all about the mission. I can't overestimate how important these past 3 years have been to Winmark to me personally. And I just think the standard for any company, for what anyone in my position is looking for and ultimately responsible for, is sustained excellence. I believe that having clarity of purpose as an organization allows for this. It took a very long time in my career to be responsible for a company like this, to define the mission of a company like this. And I hope the work we've done over the past few years will contribute to the sustained excellence for our franchisees and employees and the whole network. But when you have a pure mission, Matt, it really inspires people. It provides clarity. You get to amplify your message to a much broader audience than you can without it. And everyone knows what their role is. And it's super powerful. That's probably the most important mission. But I think the other one I would say, it's more on the personal side, but I think professionally, I just think it's really important to express gratitude in your personal life, in your professional life, write handwritten thank you notes. It may sound a little cliche, but you know, if you take the time to regularly reflect on how did I get here and to express gratitude and thanks from the people in your life that have helped you, I think it's uncommon. It's sad that a little bit that it's uncommon, but my parents taught me the value of this very simple task when I was a child. And I believe that writing someone a handwritten note, it can contribute to that relationship and accelerate the formation of that relationship, because you're letting that person know that what they did for you is meaningful. And you're letting that person know that they're worth the time it took for you to write that letter. And I meet a lot of people in my professional life that they seem to think they did it all on their own. And I think that's a big mistake, because I truly don't think I've ever met anyone that's done it all on their own. And it's not terribly inspiring behavior. So I just feel very fortunate for all the people that helped me in my life. And I think that would be a big lesson that I would share with people as well.
I think it's excellent lessons. And I will just say that I completely agree with you on that handwritten note point. I think that is something that goes a very long way. This has been an excellent overview of your business, the resale market, everything going on there. I think there's a lot that the audience will take away in hearing it, but then probably also viewing their communities a little bit differently. So I appreciate it, Brett. Thank you for sharing all of the knowledge here.
Thanks, Matt. I really appreciate your time.
To find more episodes of Breakdowns ranging from Costco to Visa to Moderna, or to sign up for our weekly summary, check out joincolossus.com. That's joincolossus.com.